this deer.
I want the wheels fall off on that.
Okay.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
We're trying to figure out which timer we're going to use. It's a very important part of our marriage. My God, we got more stories of trying to do workshops together. I forget where we were, somewhere in the South, and Katie's talking, and they had to set up at a table with two microphones, and at one point she goes, "What is that noise?" And I didn't realize I was doing it, but I leaned forward and I was going. Yeah, that's right. Charlie Parker, alcoholic. Hey, everybody. I'm really looking forward to today. There's so much to talk about, and we haven't done this in a couple of years, so it should be some fresh stuff and that sort of thing, but we'll see where it goes. I'm having a great time getting to visit with everybody. I mean, you know, Zoom is Zoom, and thank God for it. And you know, but I mean, it's really good to the you're my people. We talk a lot about identification on page 18. When we talk about singleness of purpose, and that on 18 it says, you know, until such an identification is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. And just getting to be together and the energy of one alcoholic, you know, and I always say that's why a geographic cure doesn't work for us, because without recovery, I mean, you could park me in Atlanta and then within 10 minutes I'm going to go, he looks like he knows what's happening, you know, and here we go again, you know. But we're going to keep rolling through the steps, and I got prayed up this morning, so we'll see what comes out. But, you know, I enjoyed meditation this morning. Karen did a great job in there, and that's a very cool room to get to do it in. The view we get while we're doing this is pretty amazing. I mean, I'm looking right out across the ocean and sort of thing. But, you know, so we did one and two last night, and, you know, when I say I had my biggest spiritual awakening at 17 years of sobriety, that sounds funny, and it's like, what does that even mean, you know? And there used to be a guy in our group at home, Northland, that he said, I didn't start working the steps till I had 10 years of sobriety, and he thought, that is ridiculous, you know? I mean, what's he even talking about? And Katie, would you hand me my coffee, please? And I'm a little short on coffee. Thanks, honey. But one of the things I like to talk about is unpacking that a little bit. You know, if I had this big experience after being around for a while, and I was very much about staying sober, and I'm very much an AA member. I was going to meetings. I had worked the steps, and so sometimes it's interesting to kind of unpack what happened in that experience, and I like to talk a little bit about what my program was like, my first pass. I always like to say that, for me, it's kind of like what it was like, what happened, and then what happened, and what it's like now, you know? because my first time through the steps was basically like, are you alcoholic? Well, sure, I must be, you know, because I didn't know anybody that drank more than I did, and I've met some since then. We have some very impressive stories in this room. I mean, this is the only group where you can say, you know, I crashed the car and blew a 4.1 blood alcohol level, and I lean over to Chad and go, 4.1, that's pretty solid right there, you know. I think I got to get to know this guy, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about physical allergy, mental obsession, hopeless state of mind and body, the terrible cycle of alcoholism and that sort of thing. It's just like, you're probably alcoholic. And then, do you believe in God? And well, we had to dance around that for a long time because I was agnostic when I got here. And I just love in that chapter with agnostics where it says, that's not really going to be a big hindrance to a spiritual experience. You know, you're like, what? I mean, it's like, that's supposed to get me out of that conversation when I say I'm agnostic. Nah, no, not going to be a big problem, you know. But when we got into third step, it was basically like, turn your life and will over to God. I've heard I've heard people say, you know, it's just a decision to work the rest of the steps. And we basically went right from, you know, in A, B, and C, and how it works, that we read in every meeting. It, you know, it says, A, that we're alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought, which is where we've started chanting like a bunch of kids at summer camp in the last 10 years. But I don't get me started on that. Maybe a little bit. And just you don't have to do it. You know, I mean, it's like it's optional. I just want to start doing random chanting, you know, like I've got Tourette syndrome or something. You're just like, never fail. Never mind. But you know when something's weird in AA is when they didn't do it when you got here. You know, I mean, because if they start changing things, you're like, well, that's weird. You know, because like when I got here, I said I wasn't going to get off on this, but here we go. You know, when I got here, you would do the Lord's Prayer, and they would say, "Keep coming back." And you're like, okay, all right, keep coming back. And then they start going, "Keep coming back, it works." And you're like, okay. And then it's like, keep coming back, it works. If you work it and you're worth it, so work it. You know, and you're like, oh, for God's sake. You know, I always picture this new guy coming in going, my God, I want to stop drinking whiskey, but do we have to do this whole shave and a haircut? Two bits, you know. So, I mean, and you know, at the end of the Lord's Prayer, you know, they got to do, you know, that's where I'm going to stop after this, too. But turns out, amen is a kick-ass way to end a prayer. You know, I mean, we're the only fellowship to think, you know, I think we can put a little bit better ending on the Lord's Prayer than say, Jesus did. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, okay. I just say amen, you know. But what do I know? And I could change my mind tomorrow. But we're going to talk some about, because some of this stuff is stuff that I believed for a long time, and then I started seeing some things differently. Myers came into my life, and then Mark Houston came into our life, and changed a lot of things. And you know, one of the things that Mark used to like to say is, "I can't stay sober off. I can't live off of food I ate last week." And I can't stay sober off of a spiritual experience I had 25 years ago. You know, so when we're talking about, you know, having new experience, current experience and stuff like that, there's a lot more available. And I was talking to somebody in the hallway last night saying that what turns out to be a powerful message is when you got somebody that's been in and out of AA for 15, 18 years and they're coming back into AA. And you know, Chad and I were talking one day and he said, you know, we were saying that for most people, doing AA again, you know, I'm at a bottom, I got to stop drinking, I think I'm going to do AA again. For most people, going back to AA means going back to those meetings and quitting drinking. And it has some effect, but if you got alcoholism the way I got it, that'll keep a guy like me sober right up to the point that I drink or blow my brains out. And the wonderful package of untreated alcoholism is that everybody gets to go on that journey with me. My whole family and all the ones that are close to me get to share in this wonderful package of untreated alcoholism. And my kids have seen, you know, my kids have never seen me drink, but they've seen some untreated alcoholism. You know, I mean, there's been some episodes where you wouldn't want videotaped and sent into the general service offices. You know, here's an example of 7 years of sobriety right here. But what I was going to say is when you got a guy that's coming back in, he's thinking, what's going to be different this time? You know, I've been doing this thing for 15 years, and I come back to the meetings, and I do okay for a while. And then I twist off. And the thing is, you know, if you had a 1,000-foot camera on one of us, if you'd be able to tell within a matter of days, he's going to start a fight. He's going to be out the door. He's heading for the door, you know. And it's like if I just come to AA and only go to the meetings and don't do any of the stuff that our book suggests and I drink again, I tell guys when I'm talking about the treatment center, I go, if you get out of here and you just go to meetings and you don't do any of the stuff our book suggests, and you don't get a sponsor and you don't work the steps and you don't make those amends, and you drink again, do me a favor, don't tell anybody that AA didn't work for you. You know, tell them, you know, I don't know whether it works or not because I never really tried it. You know, I went to the meetings for a while and when you to be able to tell the guy, there's two groups of people I really like to talk to. One is the person that's been in and out for a while trying to figure out what's going to be different, and the other is somebody that's been here for a minute and not doing real good. I know that doesn't apply to any of us, but there's times where you're thinking, man, is this all there is? And to be able to say that there's a new experience available in that is a big message, you know. And so when we talk about, it turns out that step one meant something a lot different than I thought it meant for a long time. And there was a lot more to step one, and everything we talked about last night. Our book spends a doctor's opinion in the first 44 pages of the book talking about step one because it drives everything. And you know, and then you got other chapters. We did this conference called Chapters in Recovery one time, and instead of giving everybody a step, they give you a chapter, and it's down in Florida. And the chapter, I had an hour, and the chapter they gave me was Into Action. And I'm like, so let me see if I got this right. I got an hour to cover the fifth step, steps 6 and 7, the entire amends process, and steps 10 and 11. And I'm like, gosh, I hope I don't run out of anything to talk about. You know, that's going to be a tough one. You know, but what is it that happened? You know, and I want to get around at some point in this period I'm talking about. I want to tell you a story about what just happened with us this winter, and I don't know how to blend this into the story yet. But when we talk about God and the power of God, when we say I'm happy to be here, I'm just going to roll it out right now because a lot of you have heard me talk about Dallas Cowboys and everything that goes on around that, and I'm sure we're all Dallas Cowboy fans here. And, but Katie and I bought this ridiculous package of seats and all these privileges at the Cowboy Stadium and stuff. We've been having a ball with it, but I mean, I sit 3 feet in front of Jerry Jones. It's ridiculous for an old East Dallas drunken idiot. You know, it's pretty amazing. You know, sometimes. But if we go up to the game, I'm not even going to attempt to blend this into the third step yet, except for maybe at the tail end. But we go up for a Monday night football game, and my 99-year-old mother lives in Dallas, and so we go to her house, and then I said, "Hey, Katie." You know, I grew up in Dallas. I go, the state fair is open. Now, why don't we go out and get a corn dog? And most of you may not know that the corny dog was invented at the Texas State Fair in 1942 by Neil and Carl Fletcher. And the Fletcher's corny dog. In fact, anytime you have something that's like where you go, every piece of focaccia bread I've ever had is in a range like this, except for, boom, this one place has it. And I'll say, well, that's the Fletcher's corny dog of focaccia bread or something like that. You know, it's that different from any other. So it's important to go get a corn dog. And I said, why don't we go out to the fair, push mom around? You know, the game's not till 7:30 tonight. And then, you know, we can look around. And so we go and we're laying on mattresses and looking at arts and crafts and checking out stuff, you know, massage chairs and whatever they got in all the little booths in the building. When I said let's go to the fair, Katie goes, oh, now see, she goes, you always try to pack too much in. You want to do 1,000 things in a day. And I'm like, so? You know, so she goes, okay, we'll go to the fair. And, oh, my God, have you heard Katie talk about how much she hates history and that sort of thing? And my family loves museums and stuff. And she just, she looks like a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old that's been drugged to Europe with this family where he's just walking around going, oh, wish I was back home with my friends playing video games, you know. And so we're at the fair one time, and we're pushing my mom around, and what do you want to do, Mom? She goes, well, I'd like to see that History of Texas exhibit at the museum. Katie goes, well, she's like, there is a museum at the fair? I thought we were going to play midway games and, you know. So anyway, we go to the fair, and I don't know where this story will go, but we go to the fair, and we're walking around the automobile building, this building, that building, and we're in this one building, and this guy's got like a autographed football by Jason Witten from the Dallas Cowboys, and he's got Dallas Cowboy pictures all in the booth and everything, and it catches my eye, and I go in and I start talking to him about the Cowboys, and it turns out, and Katie's talking to my mother, and after a few minutes of talking to the guy, I go, what are you doing? And he goes, well, we are a company called Advanced Body Scan, and we do preemptive healthcare screenings and stuff, and we're endorsed by a lot of Cowboy players and stuff, but that's what we do. And Katie perks up. She sees this machine they had. She goes, I'm interested in this. And so I can talk Katie into doing whatever she wants to do. And so all of a sudden, you know, we're going to get this scan. So they had a special, and we sign up for the scan. And 3 weeks later, we come up to another, they said, schedule it now. So there was another game 3 weeks later, home game. So we'll go then. We'll spend the night at mom's house, go Monday to their hospital. And so we go on and walk into a double-barreled sales pitch like you've never experienced. I mean, at one point, they're like, you can buy this package for $30,000, or you can buy this package for $14,000, or, you know, I mean, if you don't really love your family or anything, you could buy this $7,000 package. And I'm like, boys, I was just eating a corny dog, you know? I mean, I ain't trying to drop 14 dimes on it, and I feel great. But anyway, this goes on for 2 hours, and we finally go down and get the test and go home. And 2 days later, on my 65th birthday, I get a phone call. I'm sitting at my desk, and a guy goes, Mr. Parker, I'm the physician's assistant for Advanced Body Scan. This is not a commercial. I probably shouldn't even be saying the whole name of the thing. But he says, I'm the PA for them, and I've been looking over your tests. And I'm thinking, I don't like that you're calling me 48 hours after. And he goes, it turns out, you have a sizable mass on your liver. I said, really? And he goes, yeah, it's 14 centimeters. I'm like, what? You know, I mean, and I'm hoping it's 14 centimeters like a cigarette or something. But anyway, he says, we can't rule out anything until you go get more tests. So we need a test with contrast. So I go on and get, and we call our general practice doctor, and he goes, who ordered this test, this scan? And I'm like, I guess Katie did, you know. And so MRI with contrast, he's like, and I keep wanting this doctor, my liver doctor, tell me, because I had hep C a long time ago, and that's all been cured and everything. I keep waiting. I'm like, I really need for you to tell me I'm going to be okay. And he goes, yeah, I know, but let's just go get the blood work and see what. I'm like, oh, I don't like the way this conversation is going. So I go get the blood work. He's like, boy, the blood work looks great. No indicators of this and that, but, you know, very little chance of cancer with given this blood work. There's no cirrhotic tissue, no markers and all this. And so, but we got to get a biopsy to see what the heck it is. So I go in and get the biopsy, and they go, well, you know, sure as hell it's a hepatic carcinoma. And it turns out it's a cancerous tumor about that big, and it's right in the middle of my liver. And we go to this surgeon. There's this hot shot surgeon there in Austin, and I mean, we were talking about God from the very first visit in this guy's office. I mean, we're in his office, and he says, I haven't told this story too many times. So he says, you know, I got as big an ego as any surgeon you'll ever meet, but we all know who the great physician is. And every visit was like that, you know. So he says, we can do this treatment, we can do that treatment, we can, you know, shrink it, we can shrink it with radiation, or we can remove a section of your liver. We got to look it all over. And he says, but Charlie, if you don't do anything, this gets worse if people die from it. And I said, like any good alcoholic, well, how long would that take? And he says, a mass the size of yours, average survival period is about 3 months. And I was like, it's the first time I've ever experienced a cold sweat. When he said that, I was like, ooh, you know, because, I mean, thank God for that corny dog, you know, because so we go in on January 19th, and they cut me from here to here and over to here and just opened me up. And after the, it was a six-hour surgery, and after the surgery, he comes into Katie, and he goes, it went great. He says, we got it all. We got complete containment. It hadn't spread anywhere. And he is cancer-free. And it was just, I should show you the picture sometime of what they took out of me. It looks like a pot roast. I mean, they took a 4.5-pound chunk of liver out of them, and it had this tumor right in the middle of it, and they were able to just take it out, set it aside. We had, you know, a pretty horrible experience in the hospital, but I mean, it's and I feel great. It was the weirdest thing. I mean, it was like, feel great. You got a big tumor, massive surgery, recovery process, feel great again. You know, and I mean, it's so fortunate that we're not doing chemotherapy and radiation, and yet, you know, in AA we have to learn to say yes. But anyway, that's when our winter took place. So, you know, when I say that I'm happy to be here, it's just this is such a wonderful part of our lives, and getting to talk about AA, and we love the program Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's done for us and the people we've met in this program and that sort of thing. But you know, I'm not some prosperity preacher that's going to tell you that, you know, if you just believe, you know, that she'll come back and you'll get the big job, or, you know, or cancer will be cured, because there's better men than me that have died from this stuff. But what I can tell you is that this program and this process can get you into a relationship with your higher power that will enable you to be able to face a situation like that without being consumed with fear and what's going to happen. And it's amazing. In the third step promises, it says, we'll begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. Well, this was the first time I'd ever looked right down the barrel of hereafter, you know, for a couple of months, you know, because, boy, you know, just November, December, and January, death was on the table, you know, and it was amazing how little fear and panic there was. So thanks for enduring that story. But I haven't figured out exactly when to, you know, merge that into the rest of my talk yet. It's like, now I got to do the pawn shops and the plane crash, and it's like, my God, I've survived, you know, motorcycle wrecks, plane crashes, you know, thyroid cancer, throat cancer, you know, liver cancer. Let's just keep going, you know. But when we talk about the third step, it turns out, you know, one time, one of my favorite stories is we were in Arizona, and Katie was doing a talk at this outside camp. I'm terrible about mixing up stories. I go, remember when we were in that barbecue restaurant in Alabama with Danny? And she'll go, we were in Kentucky at a Chinese restaurant, and we were with Mike Lorenz. You know, I'm like, well, all right, but I mean, if it's not a critical part of the story, just let it go, you know? I mean, but why did I say that, Katie? So we're in Arizona, thank you. We're in Arizona, Katie was talking, and they said, hey, as long as you're here, you want to do some kind of a workshop or something Saturday afternoon? I said, sure, I'd like to do a workshop on the third step. And this guy came up to me, he's 38 years sober, lived in Alaska, and he came up to me and he goes, how do you do a workshop on step three? And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, well, I mean, what is there other than step three? And I'm like, I really hope you come, you know, because there might be a new experience. And boy, it's hard to get one of us to have a new experience sometimes. If you come at me with something that differs from my belief system, or God forbid you come at me with something that differs from what my beloved sponsor told me. My ego goes into self-defense, and that because I got two choices. I either got to look at what you're saying or blow you up. And it's a lot easier to blow you up, in my experience, than to look at doing something different. Because one of the things I see a lot with guys that I work with is sometimes we're like, and myself included, we're like, I want things to change. I just don't want to do anything different. Can you give me a package like that, where I could just keep doing what I'm doing but feel a lot better? Because a lot of times guys will call me with a 10th step, and we do a little circle and triangle check-in. I got no idea what I'm going to talk about this morning, but we do a little circle and triangle check-in sometimes where you at with the three sides of the triangle. Unity, what have you been doing in the fellowship, that sort of thing. Service, what kind of stuff have you been doing in the service arena? And then the bottom of the triangle is recovery, where you at in your step work. And in a pretty short order, you get a pretty good beat on how guys are doing it. And I can't tell you how many times I've been talking to guys, and I go, now, let me see if I got this straight. It sounds like you're not doing anything, and you don't feel very good. And my favorite was one of our newer guys in our little crew. One time I said something like that to him, and he goes, okay, now listen, I'm going to tell you this story one more time, and I need you to really pay attention, because this is really simple. It's like, I do not like your take on the way I told the story the first time. But so when we talk about what's different in step three and what was this new experience, I think my experience in that first pass through the steps was we went from see that God could and would if we were sought to the third step prayer. And when I did the third step prayer, and I was open to being willing to believe in some of this stuff. And then we did inventory and six and seven, whatever. And then we made some amends. If I really screwed up, I'd do a 10th step on it. If I could really tell I'd made you mad or something, I would clean it up. But then prayer and meditation, this is an oversimplification, but basically the biggest part, on a good day, I had the 24-hour day book on the back of the toilet, and you might as well have read it and gone, okay, God, see you tomorrow. And then I'm out living a life based on self-will, and I can't figure out why I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody and that sort of thing. And so it turns out that it's mentioned in our book, because after that A, B, and C, the next line is one that I didn't read for a long time. And it says, being convinced we were at step three. Being convinced of what? A, B, and C. So if being convinced of A, B, and C puts me at step three, then A, B, and C must do a pretty good job of summing up one and two. And that it says that we're alcoholic and cannot manage our own lives. And now we know what that means. They're assuming we know what that means. And that no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, right? Me, my sponsor, my best friend, my wife, the counselor, is going to figure, and then see that God could and would if he were sought. And he goes on to say, being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand him. And we love to turn statements in the big book into questions. It's a wonderful experiment to when you come across a line that makes an assumptive statement, is to ask yourself, is that my belief? Is that my experience? Do I believe this based on my experience and that sort of thing? And sometimes it's just like, am I? Do I? But right here it says, I always picture a new guy that I'm working with. I go, okay, here, buddy, we're going to need you to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. And I think it would be a fair question for him to go, okay, but what do you mean by that? And what do you want me to do? And that's what it says. So just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? I think one of the biggest promises in the book is over on page 29. You don't have to turn there. But it says, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. That's a big promise. It's like, really, if you're suffering from alcoholism, I need to know exactly what you did. And it's a big promise to say, this book is going to show you exactly what they did to have this recovery process. So it turns out, these pages 60 to 63, we call it the self piece, but it has changed my entire sobriety and quite a few other guys in the process. But it's going to spend the next two pages talking about what we mean. And it's, when it says just what do we mean by this and what do? It spends the next two pages talking about what we mean, and then it switches over to what we do. And it says the first requirement. It turns out that there's a requirement for step three, and it says is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And I've written right there, are you convinced? Right? Well, because when I first read that line, you ever had the experience where you're reading the book and something just goes right up off the page? And that line, I'm like, good grief. Not only have I never been convinced of that, that line has never touched me because we went straight. And I love my first sponsor. I mean, you know, he taught me. I'll never say anything bad about Jim. But we went right from do you believe in God to the third step prayer. And if you do that, you skip this body of work from pages 60 to 63, which is really not that important. It's just the root of our problem and the basis of my recovery for the rest of my life. Other than that, just skip it and let us know, you know, because I'm blowing up marriages and stuff like that. And why? Well, he goes on to say, on that basis, what basis? The basis of that I'm running this deal. Now, Bill, Katie talked a little bit last time about there are some words that Bill uses a lot, and I like to chase them through the big book sometimes. And one of them is basis and basic and basically. And another one was principles and consciousness is one I've had a lot of fun with going through the book and that sort of thing. But right now we're talking about, Bill was fond of basis. And when they looked at, we use an old dictionary in our group because we're like that, you know. And we look up words sometimes, and sometimes it's pretty amazing. But when we looked up basis, it said the underlying principle, or the fundamental principle of something, or the underlying foundation of something is its basis. So Bill talks about that a lot. In the bedevilments, it says, was not a solution of these bedevilments more important than talking about the future, but I'm reading it one day, it says, was not a basic solution to these bedevilments. And so when we're talking about an underlying foundation that is a basic solution, and Bill says, on that basis of self-will, he doesn't say it's, but on that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Man, is that a stumbling block? Because I don't know about you guys, and I see it a lot with the men I sponsor, is that I think a lot of times us guys don't think we should be in trouble if I wasn't trying to hurt you. Am I the only one that, you know, so I'll go to Katie and I'll go, you know, should Katie, I, you know, she's not too mysterious about her feelings sometimes. And there are times where, I can tell you're upset with me and I probably did something wrong and I probably should know what it is. But I don't, and it probably should come to me, and it probably seems like it will come to me. But I'm telling you right now, if you don't tell me what it is, I'm not going to get it. You know, and you'll see her. I go, well, you know. But when she tells me what I did, I'm like, but I didn't mean to hurt. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. And she's like, look right in here. Look, you see anybody that gives a flip what you were trying to do? You know, I mean, and I'm like, but I didn't mean to, you know. And see, I keep going back to these motives. And even though my motives are good, I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody. So now we're talking about my motives. And then it goes on, in a minute it's going to talk about this delusion. It says, most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like am I the only one that used to read this thing about the actor and go, whatever, you know? But listen to it now. It says, each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Well, so imagine we got this little play going or a movie set, and I want to run the whole show. But it turns out the reason this guy's such a pain in the butt is because he's not the director. He's just an actor, and he wants to run the whole show, you know? And does that sound like any of us? You know, I mean, it's like, I know how everything ought to be and how everything ought to go. You know, I mean, even in the grocery store, you're like, who in the world puts the bean dip over here by the, you know, why wouldn't it be over by the potato? I got ideas about everything. And then, you know, the sound of an alcoholic changing their mind is when they explain it to me, I go, huh. Okay, all right. You know, I mean, that happens a lot in AA. You know, I had Myers explain something to me one time about twofold illness, threefold illness, and all that stuff. And I, for years, I'd said it was a threefold illness. And Myers goes, well, you know, but Charlie, a lot of people have the spiritual malady. And because I said it's spiritual malady, mental obsession, physical allergy. And he goes, but Charlie, a lot of people have the spiritual malady, but theirs doesn't manifest an obsession to drink alcohol. And I went, huh. 20-year belief system, you know, reversed, you know. but you know, it goes on to say, what is this guy trying to do? He's trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the everything. And this is me in my life all the time. I'm always trying to arrange. He's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If only, here's the delusion. If only my arrangements would stay put. If only people would do as I wish. Am I the only one? It's like, if I could just get you knuckleheads to act right, but I can't get people to take their act right pills. And so it's like, if they would, what would it be like? It says, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, but not just me. How can this be selfish? I mean, it's going to be Charlie-topia, but you're all cut in, you know. I mean, you're all in on the deal, you know. But the problem is, I've noticed, is that most people, when they get up and they're writing their little play, they never cast me as the star of the show, you know. It's not like people get up in the morning and go, what could I do to make Charlie's life better today, you know. And it says, everybody, though, would be pleased, including me. Life would be wonderful. Are you hearing the delusion in this? And then, so it goes on to say, in trying to make these arrangements, our actor may be sometimes, he may be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, generous, kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing, right? This is when I'm trying to get everything to go my way, right? And that's the way I'm going to be, unless what? Unless they don't do it, right? And then it says, on the other hand, he might be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. So I'm always picturing this halfback juking in the open field where it's like, I'm kind to this guy, and I'm getting like this guy, I can dominate, and I can yell at him, just do it, and just put it. But then, you know, Chad will blow up. He can't do it. So what's he going to get? He's going to go, oh, boy, Chad, you're the one guy that understands what we're trying to do here. I mean, if I just had more friends like you, I mean, this was, you know, I mean, but, you know, Ray Charles can see what I'm doing, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, it's always me trying to get things to go my way. And you know, and it says, what usually happens? How much of this do you want me to do? Okay, because when I talk about skipping this for 17 years, when I talk about this new experience, I think now I got sponsors that go, oh no, I got a sponsor that's only read 3 pages out of the big book, you know, I mean, because we live in 60 to 63 and 84 to 88, you know, but everything we do out of 84 to 88, it builds off of what we learn here in 60 to 63, and I think the rest of the book does. The book takes a right turn on page 60 that I missed for 17 years, you know, where all of a sudden we don't talk about alcohol anymore, you know, when we start talking about self and the way self manifests and that sort of thing, and it's kind of slippery, you know. It's like, I don't understand what you mean exactly, but it goes on to say, What usually happens, the show didn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. Anybody felt like that? And, you know, it's like, man, and he, but do I surrender? Do I look at my basis for my operating system? No. I back up, and it says he, on the next occasion, he's still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. I got married at a few years of sobriety, and then by about 4.5 years of sobriety, I had blown that up. I had blown that marriage up. So I pulled back, and I waited the appropriate amount of time to get into another relationship, right? 16 days. And then, by a couple of years after that, now Katie's watching all of this. Katie is my best friend, like my kid sister, and she's watching it. And so a couple of years later, I've blown that up. And, you know, when we talk about unpacking this self piece, you know, one of the things that I couldn't figure out was my role in the way, because what I've noticed is that what I would try to do and what some of the, do I have time to tell? I'm going to tell one story about being out in Utah one time. Okay, you got it. Jay and I went out to Utah one time to do a workshop, a men's retreat. And this was a good crew. These guys would get guys together on Friday afternoon. They'd cook lunch at Dan's house. They'd feed them, and then they'd knock the hell out of them with the big book. And it's a solid plan. And so we're sitting at Dan's house. And this one guy that we had met, his name's Brian, and he's talking about my first wife. Oh, my God, was she crazy. I mean, this lady was nuts. And then my second wife, oh, boy. And then this chick, you know, and this chick I just broke up with, I mean, she was riding on the hood of the car, holding on to the windshield wipers, and I'm sitting there listening, and I'm always looking for a different angle, you know, and I've known Brian's sponsor for a long time, and I go, Brian, do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions? And he goes, no, go ahead. I go, how do you find yourself in relationship with all these crazy women? He goes, what do you mean? And I said, well, I said, were they crazy when you met them? Or is it possible that the only difference between the way they were when you met them and the way they were when you broke up with them was the effect of spending this amount of time with somebody as selfish and self-centered as you are? And his sponsor is sitting behind him. His sponsor goes, say that again. You know, and I go, well, I mean, because what happens is I get in a relationship at A, and oh, my God, A is the best dope there is. I mean, A is where I love you and you love me, and the only thing we argue about is who loves each other more, and the sky is bluer and food tastes better and love songs make me think of you. But then over a period of time, I wind up over here at B. And B, I can do without. You know, it's like I didn't sign up for this. And so what I do is I jettison the B and I go out and get me another A. And I don't spend any time thinking about what my role was in moving it from A to B. And that's what a lot of this stuff does. My favorite part of that whole thing was we go out and we get in the car, me and Jay, and we're going to head on up to the conference. And as soon as Jay closes his door, he goes, dang! And I was like, what? And he goes, my God, man. He goes, we've been here like an hour. And you're just like, boom! And I go, well, that's my job. I'm the out-of-town guy. I fly in, drop bombs, go home. You know what I mean? And I was like, we're still talking about what we mean, and Katie does a beautiful job of describing this. But I mean, you can't say this enough. I always recap what she says on three, because unpacking these three pages changes my whole sobriety. Because, you know, most of my 10-step calls could land right here on page 61. You know, you could just pick up the phone and go, let me guess. The show didn't come off very well. Well, no, it didn't. Let me tell you what she said, you know, and you know what else? And you know, that guy at work, and then it goes on, and it says, admitting I might be somewhat at fault, right? I'm willing to look, you know, but I'm sure other people are more to blame. Oh, my God. Katie accuses me of having this blame thrower. It's automatic in my family. I mean, my ego cannot stand to be wrong, and I'm constantly looking for it. It's knee-jerk, you know. You did it, you know. And I mean, you know, well, Chad was, it was, we were out in Arizona, and I eat hot pepper powder on a lot of stuff. And so Katie says, let's sit outside. And we get sandwiches, and I take my sandwich, and I hold it up like this, and I go to sprinkle a little ghost pepper powder on it, and it blows right into my eyes. And instantly I go, we had to sit outside, you know. And Chad's like, I saw it, Katie. I saw it, you know. I mean, but it's just instantaneous. I'm sure other people are more to blame, you know. And so I'm gonna let kind of Katie take it from, but the stories we could tell about self and the way it manifests, and it's some of the most illuminating and some of the most entertaining stuff that we talk about in the Fellowship of Alcohol is how self manifests, because I am so self-centered, and I don't think so, and there's a lot of those examples. We'll probably talk about story stealing at some point.
I got it.
You got it? Okay, because I hope I get to talk about Chris at some point. I got this one sponsee that I've always said we need to just set up a playpen and workshops and take Chris around and have him just as an example of self-will run riot, you know? You know? I love this boy with all my heart. I mean, he's just unfiltered alcoholism coming right at you, you know? I mean, so where you could just like go, Chris, what are you thinking about? Well, I'll tell you what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about how I got screwed around on that last deal, you know? And I mean, I'm going to tell you one quick story about Chris, and this is my favorite one. We're having a Thursday night meeting, and one of the guys had brought andouille sausage from Louisiana. And I tell the guys, anytime you're driving through Louisiana, just bring an ice chest full of stuff. And so we're going to have red beans and rice and andouille sausage, and they're big old links about this long. And I'm steaming them in this pot. And when it's done and it's time to eat, I take the pot, the lid off the pot, and steam goes like this. And as soon as the steam clears, Chris is right there. And I go, Chris, you don't get a whole link. I got to cut it up. I go, how many sausages do you see in there? And he goes, 9. And I go, and how many men do you see in this kitchen? And he goes, 1. I'm like, I wanted to give him a whole link, you know? I mean, he just, it's like, how do you not love that guy, you know? I mean, it's just like, I get it, you know? Okay, Katie, come take over. Thanks a lot.